There are a number of you who are transplants to Grand Rapids, and you have found us through the Gospel Coalition. Not only was New City Church the first Gospel Coalition church in Grand Rapids, but my wife and I attended the inaugural Gospel Coalition conference all the way back in May of 2007. You see, I had married a bit of a theology nerd, and she had heard about this new group that was forming, and she thought it would be a good idea for us as we were thinking about church planting that maybe we should go and see what it was about. So again, we were in the praying and planning phase of New City and decided to attend. This very first conference was held on the campus of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and they housed us in dorms. The only big or recognizable names at this conference were John Piper, Tim Keller, and of course, D.A. Carson. During one session, we actually got to sit behind John Piper and chat with him in between. It was really kind of cool. My wife, still being a nerd, has the original binder from that conference with a list of like all the breakout sessions, including the names of those who were attending each of the breakout sessions. It's pretty wild. See, it's only possible for them to have done that because there are maybe 300 people at this very first conference. Today, there are thousands who attend a TGC conference. In fact, in 2021, we went to the conference in Indianapolis, and we were, even though there are lots of COVID mitigation protocols in place, we were shocked at the changes. It's a much, much bigger production than it was in 2007. I don't think they had music in 2007, did they? I don't believe they had a worship team. You know, if I had to pick a conference that more closely matches ministry and what ministry is really like, I would have to say it's that very first conference in 2007. There's nothing wrong with larger conferences and big names. There's nothing wrong with the big productions that we often see at conferences. But see, in that very first Gospel Coalition conference, everything seemed so much more ordinary. Yes, there were men there that I look up to in the faith, but it just seems so very ordinary. Due to the small size of the conference, these men were each very approachable before and after sessions. You know, so often when we think of ministry, that of serving the Lord, we think in terms of the big production. It has to be big. It has to be spectacular. We hear stories of God doing great things through others, and we want God to do those same things through us. We think that unless it is a big thing, it's not really of the Lord. See, we long for the spectacular. We long for fast growth and for ever-increasing influence, though we often disguise that in terms of, you know, a greater ability to share the gospel. Most ministry God calls us to is very plain and ordinary ministry. I would even dare to say that most ministry is rather boring. Now, consider our text this morning. We're working our way through Paul's letter to Timothy. Paul is writing to Timothy to instruct him about life in the household of faith, life in God's household. It's about how Timothy ought to lead the church in Ephesus as it engaged in the rather routine stuff of life lived in Christian community as they serve the Lord. Our text this morning is roughly 10% of Paul's letter to Timothy, yet it's not about huge outreach events or vision casting or anything of the sort. It's about caring for widows. In the midst of this very ordinary sort of text, Paul actually says something very remarkable. My prayer this morning is that what he has to say to us adjusts our thinking about what constitutes ministry and service to the Lord, about what makes a life worth living. We're in 1 Timothy chapter 5. Verse 3, Paul writes, "Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day, but she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. Command these things as well, so that they may be without reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband and having a reputation for good works. If she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened so that it may care for those who are truly widows. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. This is exciting. You know, the dynamics at play in the city of Ephesus and in the broader ancient world were simply unlike anything we encounter in our context today, right? There was no such thing as a social safety net. There was no social security. There was no other government assistance programs. If a woman's husband died and she had no children and no other family to care for her, she simply had no way to survive. Now, often a woman would receive a dowry when she got married, and the idea of the dowry was that it would provide for her needs should the unthinkable happen, but the reality was this dowry was often not enough. The plight of an older woman without a means of supporting herself was quite dire. This is actually why we see God emphasizing the importance of caring for widows throughout history. Right, all the way back when Moses was on the mountain receiving the law from God, God instructed Israel to share their crops, their own hard work, with those in need. We read this in Deuteronomy 24. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not strip it afterward. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. God is telling them they must leave behind a significant part of their harvest so that foreigners, orphans, and widows could gather that harvest. Now think about what that means, right? These foreigners, these orphans, and these widows did not contribute to the harvest. They weren't there when the harvest was growing, right? They weren't there throughout that season pruning the branches. They weren't there fertilizing it. They weren't there carrying buckets of water when the rain wasn't coming. The owner of the vineyard or the owner of the orchard did all this hard work, yet God told him that they had a right to his hard work. And I know that cuts against our American culture. Fact is, today so many think of business as all about maximizing profit margins, making the most money you possibly can with your business. And yet God tells Israel here that they must not maximize their profits. They must not seek to expand their market share, if you will. They are to leave money on the table for those who are vulnerable among them. Think of that. They are to leave behind resources for those who did not work for those resources, that they could harvest it for themselves. You know, I think we've all heard the story about the widow who gave her last penny, but rarely do we think of that story in its actual context. Here's how Mark puts it. And in his teaching, he said, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and light greetings in the marketplaces and have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." Now, given the cost of material in those days, it was all made by hand, long robes would be a sign of great wealth. Feasts, of course, were also a sign of great wealth. Jesus said the scribes not only love to show off their wealth with their clothing and with their feasting, but they love to pretend to be righteous with their long-winded prayers. But notice also, he says that they devour widows' houses. Because of these things, Jesus says that they will actually receive a greater condemnation. Now, how is it that they devour widows' houses? the very next thing he says. And he sat down opposite the treasury in the temple and watched the people putting money into the offering box. Many rich people put in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which make a penny. And he called his disciples to him and said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who were contributing to the offering box. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." Now, we know both these statements by Jesus happened together because both Mark and Luke, who record the story, put them together in this order. Yet we almost never make the connection between the two. Jesus condemns the scribes and their ostentatious display of wealth and of false spirituality, and then he immediately commends the faith of a widow who gave two small copper coins. Now, these two coins together were worth about 1/64 of a denarius. A denarius was an average day's wage. Nationally, the average daily wage in America, based on the average hourly rate, is about $200, which means this widow put in less than $3 into this offering box. And Jesus said it was all she had. She was down to her last $3 and gave it. But when we read these together, as both Mark and Luke intended, we see Jesus is not merely commending the widow for her generosity. He's doing that. He's also condemning a system in which a widow could be down to her last $3. He's condemning a system that results in a widow being so very poor, in as much as he is commending her for her great faith and generosity. This is why his own brother would one day write these words: "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction." Now, James recognized that God desires his people to care for those who are vulnerable, and who is more vulnerable than orphans and widows, especially in a culture without a social safety net such as we have today. The apostles and elders in the church in Jerusalem recognized this all the way back in Acts 6, right? There, they had a system for caring for widows, much like what we'd call a food pantry today. In fact, it was the very thing, you remember the issue they had, it was the very thing that led to the creation of the office of deacon, that deacons would be able to focus on caring for the poor. God cares for the poor and the vulnerable, which certainly includes widows. When we come to our text this morning, we should notice that something very different is actually going on from what we see in Acts 6. In Acts 6, all widows are to be cared for regardless. They are to be supported. Yet in 1 Timothy 5, there are steep qualifications for the support Paul mentions. This is because the support he's talking about is not the same as the general support for all widows in the book of Acts. So in verse 3, Paul instructs Timothy to honor widows who are truly widows. Now, he's going to define what he means, and it's not simply a woman who has lost her husband. But before he defines it that way, he points out to Timothy the duty of family. Right? In verse 4, if a widow has children or grandchildren, mind you, they, children and grandchildren, must learn to show godliness to their own household. So he says they are to make some return to their parents, and grandparents, just as they were provided for when they were very young at the earliest days of life, so they must provide for parents and grandparents at their in their latter days. Now, it's interesting that Paul refers to this reciprocity as godliness, right? It is the good and right thing for them to do. See, Paul understands that when Jesus said he had come to divide families, he meant to divide families, those who would reject those who believe in him, not to undo family obligations. Jesus was talking about those who would be rejected on account of believing in him, and yet they must count faithfulness to him as greater than family, but they also must honor their family responsibilities. Paul then defines what he means by one who is truly a widow from one who is not. She who is truly a widow, in his context, is a widow who has no one, right? She has no family members to look to for support. She spends her days praying for others. That's the second thing he lists, which is in contrast to the widows who are self-indulgent, who care only for themselves, as seen in her self-indulgence. So whereas the true widow is poor, the self-indulgent widow is not. And yet he refers to her self-indulgence as death. Now, after instructing Timothy to command and teach these things, he returns to his insistence that a widow's family must care for her. He says in verse 8 that if one does not provide for his own relatives, this is strong, he's not only worse than an unbeliever, for surely unbelievers care for their families, but he says he has denied the faith. It is so very easy for us to reduce the Christian faith to merely believing certain facts about Jesus. As if Paul's summary of the Christian faith in 1 Corinthians 15 is the totality of what it means to follow Jesus. Yes, it is true Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried. It is true that he was raised from the dead on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures. But just believing these statements is not what it means to follow Jesus, because he did these things that he might transform us, that he might change us. Accepting these statements as true does not make you a follower of Jesus. See, the gospel is a demand on our lives. In fact, Peter and Paul both refer to the gospel, or believing the gospel, as obeying the gospel. It is God making a claim on our lives. The fact that Christ died, was buried, and rose again demands that we confess he is Lord. To live in such a way that our behavior denies what our mouths claim is to actually deny what our mouths claim. We are denying the faith. You can say whatever you want with your mouth, but if your actions do not make the same claim, Paul says you're denying what you claim to believe. It's actually his point in verse 8. If one does not provide for his relatives, he has denied the faith, no matter what his lips say. The gospel of Jesus is believed, and this faith is seen in one's actions. That's what James meant when he said, "You show me your faith without works, I'll show you my faith by my works." My works demonstrate what I really believe. To fail to live out what you claim to believe is to deny what you claim to believe. Now, regarding those who are truly widows, Paul says in verse 8, she is to be enrolled. Now, this indicates some special class of widows, and the qualifications for being on this list of true widows is quite high. First, she must be at least 60 years old. Now, bear in mind that in the first century, 60 was quite elderly. Now that I'm 40-10, it's not as elderly as I used to think. But second, she must be the sort who was faithful to her husband. Now here we see a very similar qualification to overseers in the church, right? Whereas a man who would be an overseer or an elder must be a one-woman man, she must be, a widow who is enrolled must be a one-man woman. And as with elders, this is not a status. This is a character quality. If it were a status, then a widow must be the sort of woman who is married to one man. And if she's married to one man, guess what she ain't? A widow. It has to be a character quality. So to be enrolled, she must be at least 60. She must be the sort who was faithful to her husband while he lived. Further, Paul says she must have a good reputation, one of doing good works. If she's brought up children, she must have done so well. She must have shown hospitality. And he says she must have washed the feet of saints. That is to care for the needs of the saints in a practical way. She also has to have cared for the afflicted. If these qualifications are true of her, then she was to be enrolled as a true widow. He does return to younger widows in verse 11, and he instructs Timothy to refuse to enroll them. And here he gets a bit confusing when we just read through it without understanding the context. He says, a younger widow may desire to get married, and Paul says this may draw them away from Christ. Except in verse 14, he says he wants younger widows to get remarried. Well, in verse 12, he clarifies by saying those widows who were enrolled and then chose to get married, remarried, incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Now here the word faith is probably more the idea of an oath. She has to be enrolled, she's taken some sort of oath, and she's abandoning that by getting remarried. So the widows who were truly widows and who were enrolled had taken oaths, apparently, to remain widows and serve the church. Now the issue for them was not that they got remarried. It's that they had made an oath to not get remarried. And that oath wasn't just to themselves or, swearing off men all day. It was an oath they made to the Lord and made publicly. Paul says here and in 1 Corinthians that a widow or widower is free to remarry in the Lord. But the issue is they took a vow to remain single and serve the church in exchange for being enrolled. Now, we know that sometime after this, the church in Syria produced a document, much like the Didache, but they called theirs in Latin the Didascalia Apostolorum, the teaching of the apostles. They detailed similar instructions for this special class of widows in Syria, and they wrote this. Appoint as a widow one that is not under 50 years old, so it's a slightly different requirement, who in some sort, by reason of her years, shall be remote from the suspicion of taking a second husband. But if you appoint one who is young to the widow's order, and she endure not widowhood because of her youth, and marry, she will bring a reproach upon the glory of widowhood, and she shall render an account to God, first, because she has married a second husband, and again, it's not the problem, here's the problem, because she promised to be a widow unto God and was receiving alms as a widow, but did not continue in widowhood. So the real issue was a violation of her oath. The problem wasn't that she married again after her husband died, but that she made an oath to God that she wouldn't. And then she violated that oath. So to prevent the possibility of temptation to violate the oath, just don't let younger widows make that oath. Now, he explains part of the problem with younger widows taking such an oath, being enrolled as widows. Verse 13, he says, if they're too young, they may learn to be idlers. They become bored. They have nothing meaningful to do with their lives, and so the temptation would become gossips and busybodies, you know, all up in everybody business. The alternative, Paul says, for them is that they ought to get married and busy themselves with children and managing a household. Instead of being idle, they should find something useful to do. Well, he indicates the seriousness of this in verse 15, and he says, some have already strayed after Satan. That's strong language. See, gossiping busybodies are no mere annoyance. They're unwittingly satanic. He returns to his insistence that the duty of family for those who are not truly widows. Any believing woman, he says, who has relatives who are widows ought to care for them so that the church would not be burdened by them financially, resulting in the church's greater ability to care for those who are truly widows. But this raises the question, what is it that a true widow did? I mean, if there were an oath that a woman took who had turned at least 60 and had no relatives who could provide for her, and she had a reputation for good works and who had demonstrated her faithfulness to Christ and his church, what was the oath for, and what does it mean to honor such widows? Well, the word honor here is a financial term. The church compensated such widows financially. Now, this is different from the ordinary care for ordinary widows. In that same Didascalia Apostolorum, the distinction was made. It says in the very next paragraph, but let not young widows be appointed to the widow's order, yet let them be taken care of and helped, lest by reason of their being in want, they be minded to marry a second time and some harmful matter ensue. They're saying sometimes we don't want widows to get so desperate that they marry the first bum who comes along offering them a free paycheck, right? We all know the dangers that could happen from that. So again, the concern was that younger widows would not be enrolled as truly widows because they would have to take some sort of oath, and if they feel the desire and even need to break that oath, that would be bad. Better to not enroll such in the first place. But what is the special order of widows? What did they do? We don't know. There it is. A week of scholarship spent studying this text. We don't know. However, given the qualifications, it's likely they performed some sort of diaconal role, right? Since true widows had devoted their lives to praying for God's people, they had to have a reputation for caring for strangers and the afflicted. They were not those who live in self-indulgence, but lived to serve others. They cared for the needs of the saints. It seems that the difference between ordinary widows who receive benevolence from the church and these particular widows who are truly widows and who were enrolled is one of responsibility. The true widows appear to have functioned like staff deacons. The church employed them to engage in some sort of ministry, like that of caring for the sick and hurting. Whereas ordinary widows would receive assistance, those who were enrolled received substantially more in exchange for greater service to the church. This is likely the reason there's such high qualifications for this order of widows. To say it another way, these particular widows, those who are truly widows and who are to be enrolled, were not receiving the same sort of help we read about in Acts 6. There, all widows, regardless of qualification, were to receive material support from the church through something like a food pantry. Here in 1 Timothy, they're being compensated and not merely helped. They're not getting they're getting a paycheck of sorts and not merely a bag of groceries. That's about all we can say about them. This is 10% of his letter. Given the requirements for those who would be enrolled, it's likely they spent their time engaging in good works, in showing hospitality, metaphorically washing the feet of the saints, meeting very practical needs, caring for the afflicted, and offering whatever sort of assistance the church needed. There's nothing particularly fancy about any of that. Now, given how little we know of their role, it's clear it was not earth-shaking. These ladies were not being invited to speak at conferences. They were not being introduced at these ministry conferences as leading the fastest growing foot washing service, right? They were engaged in very ordinary ministry, much like Paul instructed family members to do when it came to widows in their own family. See, there's a little phrase Paul inserts in the beginning of our text. He tells family members, the families of widows, that they must learn to show godliness to their own household. But look at the verse again. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. Now remember Timothy's former ministry, right? The one he had prior to being ordained by the church in Ephesus. He had traveled with the Apostle Paul all over the world. He traveled with his merry band of apostolic church planters. He traveled all over the place. He first met Paul when he was just a teenager. When Paul visited his hometown of Lystra, Paul saw something in him, something that told him he would be useful in his apostolic ministry. And so he got permission from Timothy's parents, and off Timothy went to travel with the great apostle. At one point, Paul sent Timothy as a very young man to Corinth as Paul's primary messenger to them. Paul sent him with Erastus to Macedonia. Timothy co-authored Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, and to the one to the Philippians, and the letter to the Colossians he co-authored. He was sent to the church in Thessalonica to help them for a time, and then he co-authored Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians. He also co-authored his letter to Philemon. Like, this is big stuff. This is spectacular stuff as a guy in his late teens, early 20s. But then, in his early 20s, Paul sent him to the church in Ephesus, where the council of elders laid claim on his entire life by laying hands on him and ordaining him. And so Paul writes a letter instructing him to remain there in one place and to engage in the very ordinary, very routine work of local church ministry. Remember, young men tend to love excitement and adventure. And when they experience as much adventure as Timothy experienced in his late teens, early 20s, to suddenly be stuck in one single place to do things like make sure the right widows are enrolled, that had to be a bit of a letdown for Timothy. Did you catch what Paul said, though? The believers in Ephesus who have a mother or grandmother who is a widow must be sure to take care of those widows, but not because such a ministry is so very exciting. Believers must do so because such care of widows is pleasing in the sight of God. So it is with those who are truly widows and are enrolled as such. Whatever their ministry, it was probably a ministry of mercy, and it didn't receive much fanfare. Videos of them washing the feet of saints never went viral. There were no annual awards for the most hospitality shown throughout the year. There was no who's who among widows or best and brightest widows in Grand Rapids. There was a group of elderly women who loved Jesus and who loved his church and engaged in very ordinary ministry. And their ordinary ministry, much like that of those who cared for widows in their own family, was pleasing in the sight of God. Whether people recognized their service or not, God did. The very ordinary ministry was pleasing to him. See, following the Lord and serving in very ordinary ways is ordinary. The problem is such ordinariness often doesn't feel significant, And each one of us wants to live a significant life. But our significance does not come from what we do. It never has. It could not come from what we do. Our significance comes from Jesus. To live a life of true significance is to live a life that is pleasing to God. And a life that is pleasing to God is living very ordinary faithfulness. I want you to listen to something Johnny Erickson Tata wrote about this ordinary faithfulness. Someone once said that the challenge of living is to develop a long obedience in the same direction. When it's demanded, we can rise on occasion and be patient, as long as there are limits. But we balk when the patience is required over a long haul. We don't much like endurance. It's painful to persevere through a marriage that's forever struggling, a church that never crests 100 members, housekeeping routines that never vary from week to week. Even caring for an elderly parent or a handicapped child can feel like a long obedience in the same direction. If only we could open our spiritual eyes to see the fields of grain we're planting, growing and reaping along the way. That's what happens when we endure. Right now, you may be in the middle of a long stretch of the same old routine. You don't hear any cheers or applause. The days run together, and so do the weeks. Your commitment to keep putting one foot in front of the other is starting to falter. Take a moment and look at the fruit. Perseverance, determination, fortitude, patience. Your life is not a boring stretch of highway. It's a straight line to heaven. And just look at the fields ripening along the way. Look at the tenacity and endurance. Look at the grains of righteousness. You'll have quite a crop at harvest. So don't give up. If you are in Christ, then your aim ought to be to please Him. In order to do this, you must get busy doing some very ordinary things. You hear me? If you want to live a life that pleases Jesus, you have to get really involved in doing some very ordinary, routine sorts of things. Now, God may call you to do some great stuff, but most of us are called to do very ordinary things, things that are pleasing in the sight of God. We can desire God to do great things through us, but only if we do so that His fame and glory are proclaimed more loudly and more broadly. In his letter to the Romans, Paul tells us to present our lives as living sacrifices because they are holy and acceptable to Him. He says this is our spiritual worship. Our very ordinary lives are offered up to Him as an act of worship, and He accepts it. He is pleased by it. The truth is, God is calling each one of us to live ordinary lives of obedience and faith. This may look very different for each one of us. It might look like remaining faithful and even hopeful when your dreams and plans have been changed. It may mean loving and discipling young children through the long and often lonely stay-at-home season. It may mean replanting your life so as to care for elderly parents. Perhaps for some, ordinary worship that is pleasing to God looks a lot like waiting on Him for direction for your next job or where you should go to college or what formal ministry opportunities you should pursue. See, ordinary worship that is pleasing to God may look like praying faithfully and patiently for adult children who have turned away from their upbringing. It may be faithful endurance in relational strife and caring for an emotionally challenged individual. It may be preaching an ordinary sermon. For some, God may call you to do something extraordinary. Some of you out there might be called by God to plant a church that's going to grow to dozens of people. Wouldn't that be exciting? Whether God chooses to do great, truly great things through you, or He gives you more ordinary acts of faithfulness to do, the reality is our lives are to be presented to Him as an offering of worship. See, in Christ, even the most ordinary lives lived faithfully are always pleasing in His sight. So, New City, let's pursue faithfulness. God may well bring the spectacular. We can pray for the spectacular, but if the spectacular becomes our aim, the very thing we strive for, we will lose sight of faithfulness. We will only want the spectacular. But it is faithfulness and ordinary stuff that pleases God. See, you and I can be ordinary people who do ordinary stuff because we serve an extraordinary God. We don't have to be glorious because He's glorious enough for both of us. God doesn't need us to be extra glorious. anything. We just need to make much of Jesus, and God will be pleased.